was 3 years old when we fled South Sudan to come to Khartoum. And I don't remember very much, but I remember talking to my mother one time.
That's Sarah Patia. She lives in Kansas City now, but she was born in South Sudan. Her family had to flee during the Civil War. They came to Kansas City by way of Egypt on a long, difficult journey, beginning with that initial displacement from South Sudan to North Sudan. And she was so young when it all started that she needed her mom's help to piece the whole story together.
I told her that, did we leave in the cargo, which were we just like luggage sitting down on a plane? She was very, very surprised of how can a 3-year-old remember actually leaving from South Sudan. All I remember is just, it's just like, it's like a dream. Like when I trying to remember, it's like a dream. Just like sitting on the floor of a plane and taking off. That's all I remember.
The memories become more vivid as the family moved from Khartoum to Egypt. Life in Khartoum seemed normal to Sarah when she was a girl, but her parents weren't telling her everything.
We had to move a lot. We cannot be in one place for a long time, and I never understood why. It was something that I was never told. I just know at 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, all of us had to leave. And the next thing I know, we were in a train to up in the border of Sudan and Egypt, taking a ship to Egypt. And again, nothing was explained to me until when, later on when I was in Egypt that there was a fear of persecution. We even had to leave my father behind because no one could know that we left.
I'm Gina Kaufman, and today KCUR's Central Standard is all about stories like Sarah's, migration stories, why we tell them and how they shape what we know about ourselves and the world. Marwa Ghazali is with us from KU's Anthropology Department, where she studies suffering and trauma among refugees. She's also the daughter of migrants from Egypt. And Marwa, I want you to talk with us about your own story shortly, but when you hear the beginning of Sarah's story, what jumps out for you?
I think it's the sense of confusion that surrounds immigration and the process of displacement. Everything happens so fast, and even though these are carefully thought-out decisions, you don't always have time to think about or make sense of the continuity of the story.
Especially while it's happening.
Exactly. And I think that's what I hear in her story is this sense of confusion and then a collective effort by the family to piece the story together, to add that continuity, because I think immigration is such a disruptive experience.
It obviously matters how Sarah's story ends, but not just in real life, right? I mean, yes, it is incredibly important in real life that she ends up safe and happy and secure, but it also matters how she chooses to tell her story, right?
Absolutely. And I think it isn't just how we tell them, but how we're taught to tell them based on what we've heard from our parents. I grew up in Lawrence, Kansas, the daughter of Egyptian parents that had come from Egypt as educational migrants. So my father was pursuing his degree in engineering, his master's degree, and my mother was pursuing her degree in engineering from a university in Cairo, in I'm sorry, in Suez, in Egypt. And once they had come here and started to have children, there are five of us. I have two sisters and two brothers. They decided they had to make a call about whether or not they would go back. Now, it's a different kind of story than we heard earlier, where it isn't necessarily driven by direct, obvious violence, but by forces that are not always so visible and also equally restricting. They
Like what?
They grew up in the era of the Arab-Israeli War and under very repressive military regimes. They both had been displaced, experienced displacement. They had been forced from their homes. My mother lived in the Suez Canal Zone, which was evacuated. My father lived in Middle Egypt, which his home was bulldozed during the war.
So your story, I mean, do you consider your parents' story in some way your story? Because I think what's interesting for both you and Sarah in different ways is that you are both you possess a story, but you're also the recipients of a story.
Absolutely. I think In my research, I found that I'm really seeking answers about who I am as well and how to make sense of my experience of being in between places and in between identities my whole life. As a first generation, we have to start thinking about the long-term implications of immigration, of the choices of our parents to share certain stories with us or to hide stories from us because they think they're too painful or maybe even irrelevant.
Is there a story that your parents kept from you that either the absence of knowing that information really affected you and your sense of identity, or learning the information had that same effect?
I think learning the information on my own allowed me to understand some of the decisions they made raising us here in the United States. But their story wasn't readily available to us. They were always trying so hard to just survive, to put us in after-school programs and in extracurricular activities and to give us a sense of being at home in the United States. So in that process, there were so many stories that were lost, and it wasn't until I went back to Egypt for my dissertation, really, that I started to think about things differently. And I started to understand that the stories I was hearing from people in the cemeteries or all around, from my family, from my friends, and witnessing those events that were unfolding in the summer of 2013 with the military coup, I started to realize that it really helped me put my own story in context.
This interests me, I mean, on a personal level as well. I grew up not knowing my paternal grandparents, and their images were on the walls in our house, but I really didn't know anything about them because I hadn't been told about them. And so in my mind, all I knew is that these are people who look like me, and that one of them comes from this little town in what's now the Czech Republic. And as a young adult, I traveled to this town, and I kind of had an idea in my head that I didn't even realize I had, that this was going to be like some secret hidden home for me, that I was going to identify with these people, that I was going to look like everyone there. And it was a real shock that wasn't the case. And in fact, that to learn that the population that my grandfather had been part of there didn't exist there anymore at all because of the Holocaust, mm-hmm. really. So I arrived and saw no one who looked like me, and saw locked up cemeteries that there was no one to maintain. And it was, history could have told me that, but I hadn't put it all together. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious, you know, when your parents were omitting stories about Egypt, did that leave room for you also to sort of fantasize a connection or fantasize a second home?
Absolutely. I think growing up as a first-generation American Egyptian has been challenging in terms of figuring out who I am. And I think that when my parents, the stories that aren't present, did allow me to think about Egypt as a second home, as a place of maybe even just a place where if I didn't fit in here, I could go back there. And this is a question that comes up in issues of immigration all the time, the question of, is it possible to go back? And I was actually just speaking with my father last night, and he was sharing a story with me, you know, sort of questioning all of these elders that came here and stayed here for their children are actually thinking about whether or not at this point in their life in the 60s and 70s, whether or not they should stay or go back. And when that question continues on for a lifetime, then we are really doing something. I think we can be doing more to help people feel at home here. That being said, when I went back to Egypt, I was equally shocked to discover that I did not fit in at all. I mean, here I showed up with this labret piercing and just thought I was, you know, I knew all about Egypt, and I couldn't even follow the colloquial language people were using. My cousins were laughing at me because I had a weird Arabic accent, and they're like, we thought you'd be blonde, you know, with a mini skirt. Like, what happened? You're from America, you know? And so I found it difficult to maneuver the city. I didn't know how to ride public transportation, especially, and there was just a segment about public transportation in Kansas City here. But, you know, I just didn't know anything about the place. I realized I didn't know about my family members, and I didn't know their histories. And it became such an important part of my research methodology and my personal experience to focus on the collection of those stories.
Well, there is a program just getting underway at KU to collect migration stories from African immigrants who have settled here in the Midwest. That's what inspired today's discussion. So let's hear more about that before we get too much further. Garth Myers, welcome to Central Standard.
Thank you. Very nice to be with you.
Nice to have you. You're at Trinity College in Connecticut now, but you're also the former director of KU's African Studies Center. And this story collecting effort grew out of some research you were doing here, right?
That's correct.
Tell me about that research. I mean, what made you want to collect these kinds of stories from African immigrants living in the Midwest?
Well, I think it was really a collective effort. It began with my predecessor as director, John Jansen, a retired anthropologist at KU. And several other colleagues. And we began to really notice that there were not only a lot more Africans in the Kansas City area and Topeka and Wichita, but from many different countries. And it seemed quite curious to us because myself coming from the East Coast and many of us having had experiences in larger cities in the U.S., this seemed to be something quite different. And so in my own personal case, I did my dissertation research in Tanzania and noted that there were quite a few Tanzanians. One day playing soccer in 2001 in Lawrence, Kansas, I found that the entire team I was playing with was speaking to each other in Swahili because they were all Tanzanians. And then we discovered that there was a sizable Tanzanian community in Wichita. And what we started to wonder is, why are people coming to these less common places and to smaller towns in the Midwest, and what are their experiences like? And that's where the whole project that that I'm still a part of began.
So in your time among Kansas City's Tanzanian community and trying to tease out those stories, what is your sense of what brought people here and how things have tended to go for them in their new home?
Well, I think it's an ambivalent story. On the one hand, people are drawn to the Midwest because there are costs that are lower. There's a pace of life that I think if they've come first to a city like New York or D.C., it's a little bit calmer. The cost of living, jobs are available. And also, of course, the main thing is going to be family and social connections. But then many people also mentioned to us in the project that there's a feeling of comfort in being in an area that has a lot of agriculture, that has a strong reliance on family and is very religious, as many parts of Kansas and Missouri are. And this was frequent to hear people say that this is sort of a little bit like home, coming from Africa, because many people in Africa are very religious and have strong connections to agriculture, even when they've been born and raised in big cities.
So, I mean, my question for you, you could write a nice scholarly paper on exactly what you're describing and leave it at that, but you have parlayed that into this story collecting initiative. And I'm curious about what it sounds like the information that you're gleaning from your research isn't all that you're interested in. I mean, why collect stories for their own sake? Why do you think they're important? What are you trying to get at?
Well, I think they're very important for a number of reasons. One is that I really believe in collaborative research. And from the beginning of the project, we worked with groups like the Tanzanian Association of Wichita and the former Somali Foundation in Kansas City, and wanted to bend the research to their interests and to try to find ways in which what we found out could be helpful to the migrants themselves. And that remains a part of the story. But I think in a larger sense, I'm interested and my colleagues are interested in this because there is such misunderstanding in the host communities in the United States, where you see, for example, in places like Fargo, North Dakota, or Lewiston, Maine, African migrants now make up a sizable percentage of the population of the town. And these are places that are not familiar with migrants, nor are they familiar with Black people.
You mentioned and misunderstandings. So, I mean, what kinds of misunderstandings?
Well, people don't have the same appreciation of religious practice, styles of dress, understanding of diet. And your early segment promoting the show talked about time management, and this is something that is quite frequent from the African migrants that we've spoken with, along with the notion of self-reliance, that a lot of Africans come to the U.S. With a sense that the U.S. is a wonderland, a dreamland, and a paradise, and they're going to make money hand over fist. And that doesn't happen in most cases. And as Marwa pointed out, most African migrants have an experience much more like her parents. Most are coming for educational opportunities. African migrants are the most highly educated migrant group of any foreigners coming to the U.S. But there's still this struggle that comes in the form of, I remember one Tanzanian in Wichita saying to me, all you get is bills, bills, bills.
I can relate to that.
You know, there's none of this life of good neighbors who take care of you. And that's the sort of misunderstanding on both sides, I guess, that we wanted to articulate.
When you earlier you said that the story of Tanzanian immigrants in Kansas City was an ambivalent story. I mean, there is a collective story, but also what about individual stories is different from that collective story? I mean, has there ever been an individual story that really goes against the grain in a way that you think is important to capture? Because that sort of thing tends not to make it into like a final academic study. I mean, because that is such looking for the trends rather than the individual story.
Right. That's a very good point. And I don't want to point out any individuals without having prior permission from them. But one thing that you do see with Tanzanians or with Nigerians or with Egyptians or any number of different African communities, because we have migrants who are coming for educational opportunities, and they are already highly educated when they arrive. Something about 45% of all African migrants have a BA when they arrive in the U.S. But most of the time, we hear about struggles, we hear about hardships, ambivalence, but there's a lot of success as well. There are a lot of entrepreneurs, doctors, lawyers, business people who have really established themselves in the United States. And so there are folks like Marwa in the first generation, but there are second generation Africans coming from Nigeria, coming from Ethiopia and Egypt, the three largest countries in terms of presence in the United States, and many of them are highly successful in economic terms, but also in social and cultural terms.
Garth Myers of Trinity College, thanks so much.
Thank you.
When we come back, we'll hear a couple of migration stories from our guests, one which we've heard a little of beginning in Egypt a generation ago, and the other more recently in Vietnam. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned for more Central Standard on KCUR. Hello again. I'm Gina Kaufman, and today on KCUR's Central Standard, we're hearing about a project at KU where they're collecting migration stories. That project has specifically to do with stories that begin in Africa, but on today's show, we're inviting anyone with a migration story to call in and tell it. We also want to hear how you've honed that story over time. What details do you include? What do you maybe leave out, and why? Do you like to share your story, or do you do it rarely with difficulty? 816-235-2888 is the number to call. That's 816-235-2888, and we really hope you'll chime in. Earlier in the show, we spoke with Marwa Ghazali. She's working toward her PhD in anthropology at KU, and this kind of story is her specialty. Hi again, Marwa.
Hello.
So do stories play a special role in the migrant experience? I mean, the crucial elements of a story are kind of inherent in the migrant experience. You need a character. So you've got the person who made the journey. You need a conflict or tension in any story. And it's hard to imagine that people pick up and leave their homes without some degree of that, even if it's just an overwhelming desire to live somewhere else. And then you need a beginning, middle, and end, which every journey like this has. You start in one place and you end up in another.
Yes, absolutely. I think stories are incredibly important. They sort of take on a life of their own. And the question is, How much do we pay attention to these stories, and how willing are we to listen to those stories? I know in my own research, stories are the foundation of my methodology as an anthropologist using ethnographic field methods. But I think another story that we should also think about is the story that's being told on this side of the fence. We know that migrants have stories. This much is true. And you mentioned earlier that we tend to look at trends and sort of the overview. And what this does is it really reduces the image of refugee and refugee experiences.
Yeah, like it's in one thing is happening.
Exactly. And even now, I just made the mistake of saying refugee experiences as opposed to immigrant experiences. Because the reality is, I think in today's world, we have three primary groups that we tend to create caricatures of when it comes to immigration. We have the needy, sort of dependent, represented by refugees and political asylees. We also have the sort of infiltrator character, which is becoming more relevant today. And then we also have the freeloader, which is a huge issue that we see in narratives that are prevalent in American society.
So the stories that people in the host country tell.
Exactly. And what shapes attitudes about migration and the fear of change and difference. Now, the stories are a way to undo that fear, to rehumanize the experience of migration, to not only show that there is a character and a protagonist and a conflict, but that the conflict does not simply end through resettlement or through the movement. In fact, it can complicate a lot of people's lives.
So that's not the end of the story.
It's really not. It's the beginning of a new story or the continuation of another part of the story. And people that have told me their stories have talked about how coming here has really led to complications, as in the case of one woman who was actually, her husband died, and then she was married off in the camps in Kakuma to a man as a second wife, to have sort of a guardian. And when it was time to resettle, her husband had to go ahead and resettle with his first wife. So she had two young children to care for suddenly. She was a divorced woman and a single mother in the United States in a place where she didn't speak the language. And that was something that had absolutely changed as a source of conflict after she left the camps and came here.
Well, I want to hear another migration story. This one's firsthand from Vietnamese immigrant Kenny V. Hi, Kenny.
Hi.
So you live in Kansas City now, but you came here alone from Vietnam as a young man, right?
Correct.
And I say this, I'm looking at you, you are still a young man.
Well, thank you.
To begin with, can you tell me a little bit about what your life was like in Vietnam?
Yeah, absolutely. It was very different, easygoing. We went to school from 9 to 5. We went home. We went out with friends, and we went out with families, and that's pretty much what I did.
When you say we went home, what was home like?
Very secure, you know, very warm.
Why did you want to come to the United States?
I like to travel the world, and most of all, probably because of the education.
So how old were you when you decided, when you started imagining coming to the United States and getting an education here?
I would say maybe 11.
Really? That's pretty young.
Yeah. I don't know why I watched the TV and I heard from my parents about, you know, getting a degree in America is like something very extraordinary. And I just formed my dream of coming to America.
How did you go about making that dream a reality? Did it start as early as 11 or did that come later?
You know, it's really different. It started when I was 11. I was thinking about all the plan to go to America, but as a child at the time, I couldn't do anything. But when I just graduated from high school, and then I went to medical school in Vietnam for 1 year, I just started to apply for, like, to be an international student. And they accepted, and I flew to America.
Was it hard for you to leave when the time came, even after all this dreaming?
Actually, no.
No, not at all.
Not at all. I feel very lucky that I don't have to experience all the conflict of, you know, other countries, like war and, you know, different things. It was just a peaceful plan to come to America. But after getting to America, then I feel the struggle,
the struggle. I mean, can you describe what you mean by that?
Yeah, more about the language barrier. 8 years ago, I wasn't able to respond. I was understanding what American told me and talked to me, but I couldn't respond back. I went to school for about a year in ESL classes, and after that, I got better with English, but still, like, a job, lifestyle, cultures, it's just different.
So do you remember the first moment you set foot on U.S. soil? I mean, do you remember that moment of, oh, my God, I'm here?
Yeah, I did, actually. I arrived at L.A. airport. I didn't know where to go, to be honest. I follow people around, and I have to wait 12 hours for my next flight to Kansas City from L.A. So I was very tired at the airport, but I couldn't sleep because I have all my luggages. I look around for people walking, so I basically just stay up for straight 12 hours. And it's just a different environment. Excited, but a little scared at the same time.
When you, I mean, you've talked about some of the challenges that you've experienced since you arrived, mostly, it sounds like, early in your arrival. Were you surprised by those challenges, or did you kind of expect them?
I kind of expect them already, and I just go with the flow, actually. I don't want to feel like I got treated differently, and not really. I was treated with respect from everybody. It's just a little different because as an international student, you don't have the opportunity to grow. You can go to school, you can have a degree, but you cannot work at this, you know, without the papers. So that is just hard with that part.
You said that you don't want to feel like you're treated differently. Does that affect the way, not only the way you tell the story of how you arrived in this country and what's happened to you since you got here, to other people, but does it affect the way you tell the story to yourself?
No, actually, you know, the difference that I'm talking about is probably more about my hair color, my skin, my language. I do different than most of American do. Like, I went to school. I'm not talking to anybody at the time because I was shy. But after that, for the first 4 years, after that, everything was fine.
After that, everything was fine. I mean, would you say that, Marwa, I mean, as someone who studies stories about the immigrant experience, that do you think that a conclusion where, sure, there are struggles, but that ends with, but after that, everything was fine, is that an important and useful conclusion to a story?
I think that it's definitely where we hope people will end up when they migrate anywhere. That they'll reach a point where they feel closure about this experience and they finally learn how to talk about it and how to tell the story. But I don't think that that's how many, at least not in the communities that I've worked with, many people feel or many people actually are able to achieve that. You know, my family is one example of a different outcome, I think, a successful outcome. We have all gone to college and we've all excelled beyond that. I have a sister who works as a surgeon and brothers in engineering and safety management. And
so in terms of the American dream, success story, totally.
Success story, totally. But then you think about, well, what constitutes success? And I find myself caught between what values I've been brought up with in my home and the values of American society as a woman, you know, navigating sort of a patriarchal kind of culture that I only know through my family and community that I grew up in with immigrants and the values that we celebrate as American women here in the United States. And as of late, I've really had to think about how I tell my story, which is a question that you brought up earlier. Even someone like me who deals with stories, I have a hard time figuring out what story to tell and which audience to tell that story to. It's never unconscious. It is always a conscious part of being a first generation You think about how people are going to perceive you, especially someone like me in this time, during this day and age, where dark skin and dark features, where you look like you might be Middle Eastern or North African. We're not really sure. There's not really a Middle East geographically, but let's just call it that. You know, Egypt is in Africa. Let's call it Middle Eastern. You start to feel that you want to separate yourself. And so for a long time, I was going with, I'm not Arab, I'm African, you know, and do you guys know the map of Egypt, you know, of Africa and see where Egypt is? And there was this whole tendency of pushing myself away from that identity of Middle Eastern. And we actually even did a DNA test through one of these sites and found out recently that we even have some Southeast African Bantu in us, along with Middle Eastern and North African. And so,
and that felt important to your story.
It did. It absolutely did. Because even growing up within an Arab community, I felt as an Egyptian of darker skin that I wasn't as appreciated. And there are hierarchies within these communities, which is something that's so important to get out in these stories. These stories tell you that. I remember being working with Somali Bantu women who called me and said, we need to talk to you. And I went over there and they were all up in arms about this community garden project. And they wanted to voice their concern to me that we don't want to plant anymore. And without the story of the Bantu in Somalia and how agriculture has played such an important role in differentiation and subordination, you don't understand why women who come here with this opportunity wouldn't want to take it. And yet, back home in Somalia, being an agriculturalist puts you at the bottom of the rung.
I want to ask Kenny, who was just telling us his story about coming to the United States from Vietnam. And mostly, it seems like the real story for you, with the place where there's been the most tension, has been everything that's happened since you arrived, and that tension has largely been resolved. But I'm curious about whether the way that you think Americans perceive either Vietnamese people or Asian people has affected the way you tell stories, sort of in the way that Marwa was just saying. She's aware of certain ideas that people have, and so she's been careful to craft her stories that she tells in a way that establishes her in a different way.
Right. You know, I'm a little different. I don't really tell people the story of how I comes here, of how my family in Vietnam and all that thing, just because I want to feel like I fit in the society of America, you know, here. I talk to people just like the business, school, different things that, you know, that I know of. I don't talk about things like political, or I don't talk about immigration. It's just different for me.
But it sounds like that also is part of a decision about how you want to be perceived, that that you're an American, so that story doesn't, that no one needs to hear it.
I would say, you know, the older generation, the Vietnamese society that came before me in 1990, 1970-something, they have more stories to tell more than me. For me, it's more about education. It's more about the experience that I have here. I just don't have the people to guide me. At least with the people that come here before me, they have the guardian. They have somebody that can show them. For me, I'm just by myself. I learn from my own experience. And to be successful, I have to be very, really fit in with the society.
And so that means not thinking so much about the immigrant story.
Correct. I think of myself as an American.
Marwa, I mean, I'm really struck by the ways in which there are audiences for our story, but that those audiences include ourselves. And I mean, it does seem like Kenny is both telling his story to is not telling his story to the people around him, in part because of a need to
blend in.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And I see this in my research with the Somali Bantu a lot. Actually, there was a moment in Somali history where the former president, Sayed Barre, burned a tribal effigy and buried it in the sand. And this symbolized the end of the tribal system and the end of all the differences that kept people segregated from one another. And during that time period, just to fit in, the Bantu stopped talking about their history of slavery. They stopped talking about the economic history of southern Somalia, of agriculture, of the need for agriculturalists in a predominantly nomadic pastoralist society. And over time, what I noticed in my interviews and in the narratives I collected was that people were really confused about causes and effects. They didn't have this part of the story that told them about the economic reasons for Black inferiority. And so they would look at me and they would say, "You're so light. You're so white." And I've never been called either of those things because I consider myself to be quite dark-skinned, quite tan. And delving deeper down, their comments about their hair being kinky and ugly, these sorts of self-image issues emerged from the absence of that story of slavery.
Marwa Ghazali, Kenny V, thank you both so much for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Next Monday evening, that's May 9th, there will be a forum on migration stories at Unity Temple on the Plaza. It's the kickoff event for KU's project collecting stories from African immigrants. Some of today's guests will be participating, as well as acclaimed Nigerian novelist and poet Chris Abani. For details, go to migrationstories.ku.edu. KCUR's Central Standard. We'll be right back.